A transit camp near Fairford. Sentries at the gate. Serious barbed wire. Incommunicado. This was an airborne unit of 120 men, plus 30, mostly drivers, who would be crossing by one of their vehicles by sea. 120 men carrying dressings, antiseptics, bottles of plasma, anesthetics, surgical instruments. One tiny part of an invasion force that would involve, eventually, 3 million men. They nearly all were men then. Not long to wait, that was clear, but we could only guess at our destination. This account is more of a story, accurate, I hope, but uninformed, seen from the bottom, a worm's eye view. Perhaps German intelligence was better informed than we were. We've been training for a year on Salisbury Plain, regrouping after a parachute drop, getting accustomed to working at night and sleeping by day, route marches of up to 50 miles, carrying kit, and of course, routine lectures and practical training, though never seeing any real injuries. A few of the likeliest lads, definitely not me, some without any previous training whatever, had just 8 days in an army hospital with our two surgeons. All our officers were doctors, each with his own specialty. I'd been on a blood transfusion course in a biology lab borrowed from Clifton College, but I never got over my distaste for blood or needles. All medical personnel in wartime are entitled to carry a pistol for self-defense. One third of this particular unit and our sister unit in the other brigade had volunteered on the clear understanding that they would never carry or use any weapon. They were committed, absurdly, to non-violence. If you think this introductory stuff is too long, well, it corresponds to our feelings in that transit camp, and I'm trying to get back into what we were experiencing at the time. After 3 days, we were taken 20 at a time. The same 20 would be sharing an aircraft shortly. 20 at a time into a big tent, heavily guarded till then. This was it. A sand table took up most of the space. The model showed a small part of Normandy. 3 to 10 miles inland from the coast and about 10 miles from Caen. Farms, apple orchards, a wood that might delay a panzer attack from the south. Overhead power lines. No, thank you. Enemy strong points, flooded land that would hold up tanks coming from the east. Round the walls of the tent were aerial photos, hugely enlarged, taken from 200 or 300 feet, corresponding to what we were shown in 3D on the sand table. A lot to take in. And we'd be landing by night. Oh, I forgot to mention, on that sand table, some nice open fields labelled dropping zone. June the 3rd, was it? The weather broke with rain and wind. We imagined landing craft being tossed about, gliders crash landing, and us. Any breeze over 50 miles an hour suggested a heavy bump at best, and the likelihood of drifting over a wide area and losing each other. Operation postponed for 24 hours. Far too many people were already in the secret. It's now known that some responsible commanders were envisaging this Operation Overlord ending in ghastly failure. Next day, the wind did lighten. June the 5th. Pay parade. Brand new banknotes, not British. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. Printed in the UK. If we survive to buy anything, would these be acceptable? The padre led a church service of which I remember nothing at all. Letters home could be left behind for posting when we'd gone. The Last Supper. A lot went into the swill bin. Paratroopers squeezed camouflage cream from large tubes onto face and backs of hands. European skin does show up in the dark. Perhaps I should have done the same. Officers and NCOs felt for their individual escaping kit, files, compasses, maps, hidden in the seams of battle dress. Heavily loaded, we climbed onto 30 hundredweight trucks and left the transit camp forever. The villagers of Down Ampney came out to wave. Everyone knew now. On the airfield, painters were still, at this latest moment, brushing bands of white around each Dakota. No mistake possible now. But wouldn't our Dakota also be an easier target for unfriendly fire? We'd been to that airfield a few days before to fit chutes and to meet the aircrew. With this new radar, they said, we'll get you right there. And Pathfinders, landing 30 minutes earlier, anyway, they would have lighted flares. We climbed aboard through the opening from which the door had been removed and all projections masked with tape. We sat down, 10 on each side, facing one another, rather self-conscious. With a parachute on one's back and pockets bulging with shell dressings, the haversack with personal stuff must have gone over one hip, I suppose. I can't remember. Because a large pack of medical kit was strapped just for the descent to my right leg. Double summertime, still some daylight left at 11 o'clock. When it was our turn, the Dakota bumped over the field and paused to rev up at the start of the runway. Once in the air, we relaxed a bit, smokers lighted up. Through one of the small portholes, I glimpsed a streak of yellowy foam that may have been the coast near Worthing. Down there, hundreds of ships were already on the way. We wriggled and sweated, not much talk. Nearing the French coast at last. Time to stand up, all facing towards the doorway. Number one would be staring out into the night, hands braced against each side of the doorway to withstand the pressure already building up of 19 men behind him. The strap dangling from each man's parachute pack was now securely hooked on to an overhead cable. All eyes on two signal lights just beside the doorway. Green, 4 minutes to go, but it could be less. A glimpse of tracer bullets floating up towards us. The aircraft was bumping and bucking. We edged towards the doorway. Now the pilot was throttling back and tipping the nose of the plane down. Signal red. Everyone yelled, go! And Willie Jansch, in front of me, number 13, fell over. Every second mattered. Willie crawled, oh so slowly, towards the doorway. And the men behind shouted, "Kick him out of the way!" He did eventually got there and fell out. Then me. As usual, the slipstream, even at reduced speed, whirled one around until that comforting tug on the shoulders. It wasn't until next year when we dropped in Germany and were then able to speak to a German wounded, some of them paratroopers, that I realized just how lucky the British were, not only with our training, but with our equipment. Over my head now, after that comforting tug, that lovely umbrella fully open, 3 seconds can be a long time. You remember as a child the best swing you ever had? This is better. The big pack of surgical instruments was now below me, at the end of its long cord, steadying my descent. But the falling had already stopped. Softest landing ever. Landing, but where was the ground? The tops of apple trees were well below. I looked up to see my canopy securely spread over a tall beech, normally my favorite tree. I let the surgical kit, it was well wrapped up, drop to earth and grabbed some twigs to pull myself towards the tree trunk. The canopy kept pulling me outwards. No proper branch within reach. Planes were still passing overhead, full moon disappearing behind clouds, straps beginning to cut into my thighs. So comfortable for the descent, but after half an hour or more, then voices in the orchard below, foreign voices. Certainly not German. I called out in my limited French. French at school had not been a spoken language. And the talking stopped at once. Had I said the wrong thing? Or tried the wrong language? Someone stepped out from under the trees and called up in French. I couldn't follow the excited conversation down there. There were several people, but a boy in pajamas was climbing up. Level with me, he offered to cut the rigging lines. Not at all what I wanted. So he climbed higher and pulled the lines in towards the trunk. Now I could get hold of a sizable branch. I released the harness straps and, a bit numb by this time, slithered down, coming to rest just above ground level. And there I was, standing on French grass. They crowded round me, eager to know, was this another Dieppe raid, with dreadful consequences for the local population when the raiders withdrew? Definitely not, I said. This was the beginning of the end of the war. But not time for conversation. I swapped pocket knives with the boy, then took out 2 tablets of Lux soap, packed handily for just such an emergency, and shook hands warmly with everyone and urged them all to go home. It was a relief when those kind people disappeared. I picked up the pack of surgical kit and scrambled through a ditch. It must have been one of the few dry ditches in that part of Normandy. But it was full of stinging nettles. Even they didn't convince me that this was really happening. Through the ditch and onto an unmetal country lane. Anxious to rejoin my mates, and fairly sure of the direction confirmed by my French friends, I set off cautiously down the lane. What was the stupidest thing you ever did? frogs were croaking, the wind was rustling in a line of poplars, something stirred behind the hedge on the other side. I didn't feel entirely alone. Round a slight bend, I came across a flimsy barrier of wood and barbed wire across the road. Where did an enemy strong point? Where had that been marked on that sand table? But this barrier, I could have pushed it aside with my foot. While I was pausing to consider, someone shouted, well, perhaps this had nothing to do with me. I backed away towards the corner. But the shout was repeated, and as a recognizable phrase, Verdun! And a man appeared from the shadows a few yards in front of me. He wore a regulation German helmet, familiar from pictures, and he was carrying a gun with a bayonet on the end. Why hadn't he fired? In stories, we learn it's important to take the initiative. So I went up to him. It seemed a bit early, 2:30 in the morning, to say, Guten Tag, good day. And Grüß Gott would have sounded a bit too religious. So I just pointed to my two Red Cross armbands. Sehen Sie diese rote Kreuze? Ich bin Sanitäter. Und da hinten, pointing back up the road, gibt es viel Verwundeten. Ich habe viel zu tun. Which wasn't quite true. The only response I got was, come, with a gesture at some concrete steps just behind him. Well, too vexed to feel scared. Anyway, he could have shot me straight away. I went down the steps and found myself in a deep trench. It ended in an underground bunker, perhaps 12 feet by 9. There were several men. I couldn't first make out how many. No one was talking. First thing I registered was a wide bedstead, wall to wall, at the far end of this bunker. It had brass knobs on both ends, not a typical piece of army furniture. A man was lying on it, breathing painfully. Right beside me, as I stood in the entrance, was a proper army bunk, which I recognized, two tiers. I became aware of a man lying on the bottom bunk. It turned out that he was a Canadian lieutenant. There was a whole battalion of Canadians in our brigade. And he was calm and became almost chatty. In spite of a hole in the thigh, you could put your fist in. I did my clumsy best to put a shell dressing on. These were the first injured men I'd ever seen, let alone treated. It seemed that Ken Arrell, I found out his name later, Ken had landed on the top of this enemy gun emplacement, and immediately a man raising his arm as if to throw a grenade appeared. Ken, the Canadian, fired his pistol and shot the grenade thrower in the chest. This was the guy now lying on the fancy bedstead. But the grenade exploded and a chunk of metal had made this hole in Ken's thigh. This, as I said, was the first injury I'd ever treated. My mates, including those who'd only had a year's training in Bulford, became skillful and competent during the next hectic 2 weeks. Not me. From time to time, one of our captors, the same one each time, looked in to see if we were still there, I suppose. He was apparently the senior man present, the officer being out of action. Every time he came, I tried to make contact. If mate, I had been attending evening classes in German. It may have been the third time he came back. These details are 60 years old. And he did respond, but slowly. Next time it was the same. He was evidently searching for words. But he knew even less German than I did. This added to the unreality of the night. So it gradually emerged that this strong point was manned entirely by Ukrainians. The commander-in-chief had known all about this, apparently, but he'd never passed it down to me. Several hundred of them, fighting the Germans on the East Front, had been captured. And rather than be shot then and there, they had volunteered to help build defences along the Atlantic coastline. But having reached Western France, they'd been issued with German equipment and weapons and advised to defend themselves to the death if the Allies attacked their particular sector, because Americans and British never took prisoners. By daybreak, he seemed not unready to change his opinion of how the Allies might be like, really. There was heavy shelling not so very far away. Perhaps the Navy was giving support to the landing craft. It may have been in that shelling that two of my mates died. At last, by a strictly local agreement, it looked as if local hostilities might be coming to an end. A company of Canadian paratroopers, the battalion in our brigade, had captured a small gatehouse at the crossroads. Yes, those crossroads had been marked on the sand table, less than 200 yards away. The Canadians had lost five men from a single mortar shell fired by our Ukrainians. And yes, the Canadian company commander would accept surrender. The Ukrainian NCO had evidently been consulting his men. They now scrambled out of their trenches and bunkers, all 42 of them, and threw down their weapons in a heap, as had been agreed. They were all marched happily away to some improvised POW cage, if such a civilized thing can be imagined in those chaotic conditions. I would like to say that they had a happy end, but I fear very much that at the end of the war, those Ukrainians and their mates came to a very unpleasant end, sent back willy-nilly to the Soviet Union by the British government. Of those left with me and the two injured men, all who could walk quickly disappeared. They included two Canadian paratroopers, delighted to rejoin their mates, and two scared Frenchmen, a farmer and his man, who hurried home to see if their families were safe. Never was I so pleased to see a regimental sergeant major as when our excellent RSM Green looked into our smelly bunker, I don't know how he knew, and said he'd be sending help. The RSM somehow, by his very presence, suggested that things were now under control. Three men did at last appear, and with great difficulty we got the wounded onto stretchers and up to ground level. From there we carried them through the gatehouse, now deserted by the Canadians, and up a long, very long avenue to the chateau. D-Day was well advanced. Hedges were festooned with parachutes, speckly green for a man, bright scarlet for equipment. Ingenious Frenchwomen, eager for new underwear, made what use of them they could, but in creating a parachute, the nylon had already been cut into awkward strips. The dressing station proved not to be in the chateau itself, but in the stable block. Wounded men were sitting or lying on straw in the loose boxes. No doctor, but someone competent was in charge, and we did what we could. At least there was clean water, And here, bringing hot tea and fresh milk, was the stable manager, an Irishman. They get everywhere. Late in the afternoon, a sort of jeep arrived. It was a captured German vehicle, the windscreen pierced with an arc of machine gun bullets. We lifted onto it the most serious cases. The Ukrainian officer had, I think, already died. The main dressing station had been set up about 2 miles away. Before the jeep was back for a second time, small arms fire started up not far away. It seemed hours before the jeep was back for the third and last trip. The firing was distinctly closer. Lightly wounded and medics, I don't remember how many, we all scrambled on. The Irishman and his French wife and family were there to wave goodbye. There were bomb craters on the road. The main dressing station was at a fromagerie, a farm specializing in cheese production. When coming to write an account of it all that autumn, we were told that no MDS had ever been so close to the fighting, which had its pros and cons. There was no front line. Fighting shifted to and fro, one time within 300 yards of us. We were too busy to be fully aware. A 20-foot red cross spread out in the yard was not enough to stop a low-level attack on D+4, I think, from a rocket-firing aircraft with Allied markings. The mystery remains. The only casualties were the farmer's wife, heavily pregnant, and his mother, severely wounded in the abdomen. The unit started work here on the morning of D-Day with one-third of its personnel present. A lot more drifted in singly or in groups during the following days, each party with a story to tell. No time for storytelling just then, but we gathered up some of them later when the account was written. Tales of deep, water-filled ditches, bombardments, exhaustion, help from courageous French people at personal risk. Our commanding officer, to his chagrin, had been dropped with his party 15 miles away. They were all taken prisoner and removed to Germany. Of the 50 or so initially captured, about half rejoined the unit in Normandy. To start with, only one surgeon, the other had been killed, and no anaesthetist. My excellent mates had themselves to inject pentothal into the veins of patients in deep shock, their veins hard to find. Penicillin kept the death rate down. Those we lost in those first 2 weeks were, in any case, desperate cases. At one time, half the patients were German. More remarkably still, we got much needed help, and expert at that, for about 5 days from 4 German medics, nominally prisoners of war. They just appeared, I don't know where from. Of course, they were useful in looking after German wounded, but they didn't mind who they were tending, and they were treated exactly as one of us. One gave blood before stacks of fresh blood began to arrive. Another, already blind in one eye, had the second eye damaged by a shell splinter. They left us for a prison camp, on the beaches, I suppose, carrying from our acting commanding officer a recommendation, in good German, for the Eisenkreuz, the Iron Cross, Class 2. Meanwhile, medics with the 3 battalions were going out with patrols, bringing back wounded and working in improvised dressing stations. I could go on, but yes, my watch tells me I better stop. Thank you all for coming, and there will be large buckets, I'm warning you in advance, at the only exit.